Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we visit with a couple of great guests. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Lisa, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And Brian Huddleston, the Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, also known as Dr. Death.
Wahahaha.
Brian, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So, as you listen to these two experts, what's on your mind when it comes to your garden? Do you have questions about dealing with winter damage, maybe? There's a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. You can also, maybe you've got a photo of a plant you want to ask a question about or something, you can do that or just ask a question via email. And to do that, just go to ideas@wpr.org. And already some folks have done that. So we've got things, plenty of things to talk about. You know, this pretty cool spring, how's it affected gardens around the state? One of the things I noted, the spring bulbs in that lasted a
long time.
Long time.
And we kind of had a compression, I think, of a lot of flowering stuff that normally would be spread out a little bit more that kind of hung on and everything kind of got compressed. So it's been a nice year for flowering stuff.
But what about winter damage? Do you see any of that?
Yeah, lots and lots.
Lots and lots. We think what happened is that we had such warm weather for so long that things didn't properly go into dormancy in some cases. And then that warm weather was followed by, yes, we did get a little snow, fortunately. But then we had that polar plunge for the vortex that came through. And, you know, if it had just been one night or something like that, it would have been okay. But it was much, much longer than that. And it's been interesting, the species, you know, I expected the Japanese maples to be affected. And I lost one that, you know, it's 10 years old and big and beautiful. And yet another one that's only 5 years old, only lost one branch. And so it just really spotty. And you were saying you've seen...
Yeah, I've had a lot of people calling me about burning bushes, where entire neighborhoods where all of the burning bushes are showing symptoms of dieback. And again, I'm attributing that to cold injury. Mm-hmm. And I've seen other types of trees and shrubs showing problems. Lots of boxwood samples coming into my lab. We've been encouraging that, though, for other reasons. But most of what I'm seeing on those are what are probably started out as cold injury.
Yeah, and you know what? Susan and Marshall has a question about her Japanese maple tree. Let's take that.
Good morning.
I think that may relate. Yeah. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I do have a 15-year-old Japanese maple, and our house is L-shaped, so it's protected both from the north and the west, and it has not leafed out. It has two tiny little red leaves on the actual trunk, but nothing on the branches, and it's been healthy up until now.
That's not good.
To be the bearer of bad news. Maybe I'll make Brian do it.
Yeah, that's my job.
Dr. Death, what's going on?
It's probably cold injury again. I think what we were talking about before particularly applies to things like Japanese maple that tend to be what I consider somewhat marginally hardy here anyway. Yeah. So you're kind of pushing your luck to grow those trees. But I can understand why you do because they're so absolutely stunning.
And mine are in a protected place too.
And I have one too that actually Lisa put into my yard 20 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
When
it's
she
more
landscaped.
Than 20 years.
Yeah,
it's like 30.
And I noticed when I looked out the window that one of the branches on that has died back as well. So I think that's
just
probably
one branch?
Just one. Part of it's still going. I do worry in my yard, though, because I know I have verticillium in the soil. So it could be verticillium, which is another problem that will kill Japanese maple. It's a fungal pathogen that comes in through the roots and blocks off the water conducting tissue. And that'll cause kind of a sectional dieback in things like Japanese maple, but I haven't, I've not heard any or seen any of that this year come in through the clinic. Primarily what I'm seeing with things like Japanese maple is no pathogens, just apparently cold injury.
Anything to do about?
Well, not
not much.
Really.
Not much.
With mine, some of the bark actually cracked as well on the trunk. When you do see little leaves coming out at the trunk, that, you know, pretty much tells you that you've had pretty bad vascular damage and it's trying to trying to regenerate. But if you scratch the bark on the twigs, and if it's brown underneath instead of green, that usually means that there's been that twig is dead. That there's been enough vascular damage to kill it.
Oh.
So I know, yeah. You know, it's really sad when you have one that's really old like that, and that's beautiful. If you wanted to replant, the varieties I'd recommend are, or the variety is Emperor One, is probably the one that supposed to be most cold hardy here. That's what mine is, the one that half of it died. The other one that all of it died was Osheobeni, and that one has been very hardy too, and you know, in spite of 20 below and 30 below temperatures. But this was just a protracted amount of, and I think that warm weather again also played into what happened.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, Susan. It really sucks.
What I tend to tell people though is that it's really horrible that this has happened, but on the other hand, it gives you an opportunity to put in something new and exciting that you can watch grow. So trying to find a silver lining, which I'm not usually the one to do, but that is something you can think about.
Yeah.
So you may want to put in another Japanese maple, but you may want to consider some other type of tree or shrub in that area.
I'm putting in a railroad garden.
Oh, cool.
Well, we'll have to talk about that as we go along today, too. What the heck's a railroad garden? We'll learn more about railroad gardens in a bit. But, Susan, thanks so much for calling. You got one little silver lining there, and I hope that helped. We have, you know, as long as we're on trees, I think there was another called from Todd, was it?
We had somebody with the dogwoods?
Yeah, Todd and Delavan emailed. He has 6 dogwoods that were all planted 11 years ago. And every year they leaf out very full. This year they have a few leaves and no blossoms. Buds are dry and crumbly.
Yeah.
Other dogwoods in a 20-mile radius don't look much better.
Yeah.
So it's what we've just been talking about here.
Same sort of thing, I think.
Yeah. And I have noticed it on some viburnum species. With the dogwoods, I lost my Cornus cusa, which is the Chinese dogwood, and my mom had one, too, that was 30 years old, and looks like that's pretty much toast as well. So it's just really sad.
Well, on that happy note, let's take some more calls. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I have a couple of open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Obed in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guest. Big fan of your show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
This is actually my first year planting my first garden. With all this news the last few years with the decreasing number of insects, and I guess because of the loss of habitat, high use of pesticides and herbicides, I'm trying to figure out if there's any good ones that I should be using, or if there's better ways to go around it, or I guess just any help in general would be nice for a first-time garden grower.
Sure thing.
And I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Lisa, do you want to start on that? First-time gardener should – are there other things that he can do as opposed to pesticides, or if he has to use some, what was –
Sure. I was hoping he'd stay online because I don't know what he's growing. And if it was something like fruit trees, well, then you have more insects to worry about. But for the most part, in extension, we don't recommend just using pesticides as part of gardening. You only use them if it's necessary. And the first thing that you need to find out is what kind of pest are you dealing with? So that you use the appropriate product at the appropriate time and the appropriate amount. But we always recommend cultural methods first.
So plant spacing is one for me as a plant pathologist. A lot of the organisms I deal with like really wet conditions. And if you pack too many plants close together, then that tends to trap a lot of moisture, which is great for these organisms, typically fungi, to infect. So things like powdery mildews, any of the other fungal leaf spots, you can help get a little bit of control if you do space your plants pretty far apart, and then use of resistant varieties if that is applicable in a particular situation. Sometimes you have to do a little bit of digging, but that's a situation where you contact your local extension office for some advice on what varieties you might plant.
And you want to, you know, I think many people plant their tomato plants too close together.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Very common.
I mean, that's...
And sometimes it's
myself,
out of necessity because
yeah.
You don't have much room. So, but my adage for that is that you space them as far apart as you possibly can.
Yeah, and thin the canopy and put down mulch so that any soil-borne pathogens aren't able to. You created a barrier between the foliage and the plant.
And the
ground, and that you've removed the bottom leaves so that. For the same reason, and
good fall
cleanup
is another thing.
Yeah, good fall cleanup.
And a lot of it is you can find out a lot if you go to, for example, a learning store, the UW, learningstore.uwex.edu. There are a lot of good publications on gardening.
Yeah, there's also one on tomato varieties or something on that order. I can't remember the exact title for Wisconsin.
But I know there's a nice publication just on that beginning.
Yeah, General Gardening. There's one called The Vegetable Garden
by Helen Harrison.
Yeah. And that one does have some good basic information. I wasn't sure whether our caller is a flower gardener or vegetable gardener or both, but in general, you know, you don't use pesticides unless it's a last resort.
Yep.
And then if you do need to do that, you have to be careful, particularly if you're growing both ornamentals and vegetables. Certain products that have exactly the same active ingredient, one brand or one type of that product will be labeled for your vegetables. The other one will be labeled for your ornamentals, and you should not swap those around.
Yeah. There you
go. So you got to have the right product for the right situation.
And using products with the least amount of toxicity is also a good thing. So, yeah, recommend calling your extension educator for more information, more detailed information.
Kate in Menasha, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I just want to say I was out mowing, and boy, my perennial beds look amazing. I was so happy. My peonies and iris, and I thought the winter was going to be very hard on them, but they look terrific. But my question is about iris. I have a large perennial bed that is mostly heritage iris that belonged to my grandfather, and they're two or three different kinds of purple. And in the last 2 years, I've added more exotic iris from a place out in Oregon, Shriner's Iris Gardens. They're beautiful. It might just be that they haven't come up yet, but I'm wondering, are those old purple iris, are they going to have a tendency to affect genetically the other iris that are planted next to them, or is that something those plants don't do?
My iris look really good too this year.
There won't be a direct effect between the plants genetically because that's set by the plants. If they would cross-pollinate and you would get seed set, then you would get variations that might look more or less like the two parents.
Right.
But usually we don't recommend letting iris go to seed typically.
Yeah, preferably not. There has been some issue with podivirus in irises last year, and I know that the folks from DATCAP were doing some pretty, they were looking stuff over this year.
And I'm pretty sure I had an iris that came in that tested positive for
podivirus. For
podivirus. Mm-hmm.
So that is one thing to watch for in new irises. With the older irises, the thing that we mostly have problems with is the darn iris borer. And so if you notice that you have the rhizomes that are mushy or smelly, that's not actually the borer that caused that. That's the that's Brian's disease.
That's the bacterium that came in
afterwards.
But the initiator is the insect.
Yeah, is the borer. We do recommend every once in a while dividing your iris in the fall and taking them out, making sure that there aren't any borers in the rhizomes. But if they're looking good, that's all good news.
That's very good news. And mine look good. Mine look great too, Kate. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we're talking today with Lisa Johnson, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County, and Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Dave Potratz, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. Have an open line at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Sonia in Madison, it's your turn. What can we do for you?
We moved into a house late fall last year, and the yard is everything but grass. There's moss and creeping Charlie and dandelion, and I'm just wondering, like, do I just get a load of dirt and start over?
Is this a new house? So this was a new construction, or is this a house that's been around for a long time?
It's the house that's been around for 40-plus years, and the people before us just never did the leaves, and our neighbors actually came over and got rid of the buckthorn for us. They're like, you gotta get rid of it. I know, it was super nice. And they offered tools, but I just don't know what to do with the tools.
Is this area that you're talking about that the lawn grasses are in, is that in shade or in sun?
Mostly shade.
Okay, that's what the problem is then. No matter what they did, it's really hard to grow grass in deep shade. So you might want to think about doing a different kind of ground cover, maybe some native wild ginger or something like that. Now, if the buckthorn was providing most of the shade and the buckthorn is now gone, is that the case or is it still in shade?
No, the buckthorn was not. The buckthorn is just there.
Okay.
I like the idea of not grass. Sure. I guess I'm still wondering, do I just plant seeds or do I need to rip everything else out first?
If you have a lot of dandelions back there, I would not want to disturb the soil any more than I had to. Because every time that you till or put in new stuff, you're going to be bringing some seeds to the surface. So if there are a lot of dandelions, I guess I wouldn't really recommend that. And for perennials like wild ginger or Jacob's ladder or, any of those woodland plants, bloodroot, it's going to be hard. You may find some from seed, but most of those you're going to need to buy as plants.
So if she buys them as plants, but she's still got to get rid of...
Yeah, you want to get rid of the weeds. If it's a big yard, then you might need to look at chemical control. But otherwise, there's, the good old weeder for taking out particularly the perennial weeds. Now, you can certainly use mulch. That will help keep the weeds down once you've removed anything that you can see above the ground right now. So you may want to order some mulch. Hopefully, you don't have jumping worms, because otherwise you'll be feeding the jumping worms with your mulch. But is this a small yard, big yard?
It's about a little, just under a quarter acre.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Is it the whole area that doesn't have any grass? I mean, are there some areas that you think you could put grass that are in a little bit more sun?
There's a few areas of grass, but definitely, we have a front yard that's some grass, but a lot of moss, and then the backyard is moss and creeping Charlie and dandelions, and there's a few bloodroot that came from our neighbor's yard and
nice.
and Jack in the Pulpit, but in general, it's just a lot of nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would remove the weeds as best you can, and if it is as shady as you said it is, it sounds like the plants are telling you what was going to grow best there. So it sounds like your neighbors.
A lot of moss back there.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's usually not a good sign for growing grass. Yeah, so I would look into some native ground covers. I mentioned the wild ginger. Bloodroot spreads quite nicely as well. Jacob's ladder, there's a bunch of them that would work really well.
Those are all good
ones. And they're
ones.
Beautiful.
Yeah, they really
and
are.
And the pollinators love them, so.
Other things I would plant, they won't last all season, but bleeding heart, Dutchman's britches, a lot of the native wildflowers are really quite beautiful.
Yep, they
Another
sure are.
Idea.
Hostas would probably do
yes,
well
and
back
of course,
there as well.
I love hostas, so I mix those in with my natives. A lot of hostas.
And they're hard to kill.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well.
Oh, no.
Maybe not.
Says the disease guy.
Yeah. We don't want to talk to you now.
Yeah, sorry about that. No, they're pretty hardy, but there are a couple of virus diseases that hostas can have. So,
so lots to think about there, Sonia. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Sherry in Milton next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I have two questions. We have about 20 mature boxwoods that are all almost completely yellow from, I guess, the cold winter. So the first question is, if I cut back the dead parts, will they grow back? And secondly, is there a better alternative for the boxwoods that would be more hardy?
Okay. So you're not seeing spots on the leaves. You're just seeing a uniform kind of golden brown color.
Very yellow.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
probably winter
damage then. We're trying to, ascertain, are we dealing with boxwood blight or winter injury? So it's probably winter injury, especially if it's all of your boxwood. How many boxwood do you have and what kind of situation are they growing in?
We have about 20.
Did you say 20? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and
is it in shade?
Most of them are on the east side of the house. Oh. We also have some on the south side of the house, but they're pretty uniformly affected.
Yeah.
They're almost completely yellow.
Okay, so are you looking for something then that's about that size, 2-3 feet tall? Is that what you're looking for?
Yes. We like the compact size, but if we cut off the dead parts, would they grow back? I know they would look terrible.
They would look terrible.
Yeah, and there's another reason to think about replacing them, because Lisa alluded to this disease called boxwood blight. It's a new fungal disease that's just arrived in Wisconsin. They found it in Kenosha County and Dane County at nurseries. And we're expecting that to spread, and that tends to, on most of the varieties that are grown or have been planted historically, it's probably going to be a lethal disease. And so if you have an option to replace the plants now, I think you'd be ahead of the curve, because eventually you'll probably get boxwood blight and you'll need to replace those shrubs anyway. So this is an opportune time to think about doing that.
And you would replace them with a variety of things, maybe?
Different types of shrubs would be my suggestion.
Yes, and if we have light, which is good, because that certainly makes our palette of plants that you can choose from a lot larger. You might choose some flowering plants if you want to stick with evergreens. There are certainly evergreens that would work in both of those types of areas. There's a lot of choices out there.
So this boxwood blight is going to be terrible.
I think eventually, if you want to see the horror that is boxwood blight, my suggestion is to go online, type in boxwood blight, and then select your favorite state along the Atlantic coast. So North Carolina, Maryland, Virginia. And look for pictures, and there are landscapes that are totally landscaped in boxwood where every plant is dead.
Oh, boy.
And there are some resistant varieties out there. Some of the Korean little leaf boxwoods resistant. We have a fact sheet on that's available at my clinic website if you're interested in reading more. But I am really recommending that folks, as these plants get damaged for other reasons, they consider replacing. And don't plant a whole bunch of the same thing of something else. That's where we run into problems, where people basically plant all of the same plant in a landscape. It needs
monoculture.
To be a variety. Yep, it's called monoculture, not necessarily a good thing. So a variety of different types of shrubs.
That's what happens when you plant too many ash trees, and then you have
or American elms.
Yes, right. And so
which we have been
diversity
doing.
Is good.
Yeah. Sherry, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You know, Jacob's got from Evansville has a question that kind of goes along with this in some ways. I think maybe Jacob, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was wondering if you were to plant a bed of annuals versus a bed of perennials, which is better long-term for the issue of climate change or global warming, factoring in watering and pesticides and such? Thank you.
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. Particularly what we're seeing right now with climate change is that things, the weather patterns are unpredictable, which is what we've been noticing. So it's really hard to say what is going to be, you know, 20 years from now, really, really helpful. Certainly, there's less effort taken to put in perennials as opposed to annuals. That being said, I certainly am a supporter of the horticultural industry, and I don't want to be recommending that we don't plant annuals. I certainly plant a lot of them. I like to do some perennials and some annuals. I would say probably the native plants are going to be the most resilient at the moment.
That's a good point.
But, you know, beyond 2050, we just...
We don't know.
We don't know.
So there you have it. Thank you so much for that question. Appreciate your call. Jim, I think jumping worms came up in passing at least, and I know Jim emailed that he's been a straw bale gardener for a long time, and he discovered his garden was full of jumping worms, and at first he didn't see any impact other than that the worms seemed to really like to live in and eat straw bales.
Oh, yeah.
Last year, the straw bales under some of the tomato plants melted away due to the jumping worms' voracious appetite. Staked the tomatoes, which held the plant roots in place. The roots became exposed as the bale melted away. He covered the roots with more straw, and they were fine. There are, for jumping worms, are there some things you can do? I know in some cases people put a screen under their straw bales to keep rodents and so forth from coming up from underneath. Do you think that'd have any impact on?
Well, the jumping worms, because they hatch in the spring, they don't overwinter as adults, so they're very, very tiny when they first hatch. So I'm not sure whether. Yeah, that's what I'm. You'd have to have a super fine mesh, I think. What some people are doing is, you know, growing things off the ground. I don't know whether you could, that's not going to work very well for straw bales unless you're like putting it on your driveway. But even then, my mom had mulch delivered that was on her driveway, and they, I don't know, they must have come from surrounding areas when the rain came down, or else they were already in the mulch, but they got into that mulch. So they can even, you know, they can squiggle across the driveway pretty well if it's wet out. So I really don't know what the answer is to keep them out of those straw bales. Unless you had, I mean, you might be able to, like, build something that has a mesh on it that would allow the bales to be off the ground, but that's an awful lot of effort.
Yeah, it's a lot of work for sure. And now there are I've been told, I think it's come up on the show in past shows, that there were some treatments that can be, you can try to get rid of jumping worms. I don't know, you know, it'd be pretty hard if the neighbors got them too.
Yeah, but. Yeah, right. I do have jumping worms, and there is a treatment. I'm not recommending it wholesale, just for experimental use. But there is an organic fertilizer called Early Bird. Gets the worm, you know. Mm. The active ingredient is tea meal or tea seed meal, and it has saponins in it that irritate worms' membranes and brings them up to the surface, and then they die because they desiccate. Mm. It isn't, if you apply it in high enough concentration in the lab, it will kill them outright, but that's hard to achieve in the landscape. But this product, you have to water it in really heavily, and it's expensive. So not for big landscapes, but I've been holding my own, I guess you could say, but it's not, you know, eliminating them.
Yeah, so I don't think it's ever going to eliminate.
Yeah,
them.
Yeah, especially like you pointed out, that if you're, you know, you got contiguous lawn with your neighbors, well,
Yeah.
If they're not treating, then it's the same thing with Japanese beetles, where, except
or
thank God,
Charlie.
The worms don't fly.
Yeah. And diseases, too. You can do all you want in your own yard, but if your neighbors have the same plants and aren't doing anything, you're going to have problems, typically.
Let's take a call.
Boy, we've got gloom and doom here today.
Yeah, let's go to Heidi in Baraboo. Heidi,
Hi,
what's on your mind?
I have been gardening for about 40 years, so I thought I've seen and dealt with about everything. But when I went out this morning to my garden, to the broccoli plants, which are extremely healthy looking, they're about 5 inches tall, they all have broccoli on them already.
Hmm.
I planted them about 2 weeks, about 2 weeks ago, when we had that little a few days of good weather. They're the same variety, the same nursery.
What size were they when you bought them?
The broccoli is about the size of a fat M&M.
So when you bought the plants, I assume they were in like 4 packs or something like that, the same size as usual?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They must have been exposed to some kind of light regime at some point or some kind of environmental thing that is making them bolt early or produce flowers early. That's weird. But they're you say, five inches?
They're healthy. That's beautiful.
Hmm.
I cut the head off this morning.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all that you can do.
And I fertilized it.
Okay.
I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, that's what I guess I would do. Yeah. There's nothing really that you can, I mean, you didn't want to waste the heads, certainly. It'll be interesting to see whether they continue producing for you. Maybe you'll just get like a really super productive year because they're starting early.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
I was going to say you could market that as new broccoli, like they do the small potatoes as new potatoes.
Yeah, baby broccoli.
Baby broccoli, yeah. Are you going to eat? Are you going to eat what you collected?
I don't know. I'm.
Oh, you're worried about it?
I don't know.
I don't think I'd worry about it.
No, I don't think I'd worry about it either. I just assume that it's some kind of.
It'd be interesting to see if there's a flavor difference from what you would normally expect if you had broccoli later in the season.
Huh.
Yeah. There you go, Heidi. Thank you so much
interesting.
Yeah, it really is. Oh, a lot of things come up here on Garden Talk that are really interesting. Lee, what have you got for us in Green Bay?
Good morning. I just have a simple question. I planted the Accolade Elm. I have 4 of them on my property here. I've had them in for about 10, 12 years. How are they doing in resisting the Dutch Elm disease? Mine are okay so far. No problem.
Yeah, and that would be my observation in general for any of the resistant varieties. And this applies not only to resistant elms, but to resistant variety of plants in general, is that just keep in mind that resistance doesn't mean immunity. So if a plant is immune to a disease, it's not going to get the disease. So elms are immune to Septoria leaf spot of tomatoes, so it's never going to get that particular disease. But when you have a resistant variety, typically they can get the disease. But usually the disease progresses more slowly in the resistant varieties. So your elms may eventually get Dutch elm disease. I can't tell you that they never will. Mm-hmm. But hopefully if you watch them carefully and catch the disease early enough, that may provide you with opportunities to try to manage the disease with other methods. So you might have somebody come in and do injection treatments. You could certainly do that as a preventative if you wanted to. But it can be quite expensive. But I would say, depending upon the variety, some varieties hold up better than others. I've pretty much seen every resistant elm variety in my lab that has tested positive for Dutch elm disease. So they can get the disease. It's just that hopefully they'll last a little bit longer for you.
Yeah, and we need to keep in mind that the disease is spread by insects.
That's right.
Also root. Is it
root grafts
as
well? So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if they're contiguous or close to each other, you may have spread by root grafts. But otherwise, if the insect finds the plant tasty, then it's the one that's carrying the fungus.
Yeah. Next big windstorm, you get some broken branches.
Yep. That's another thing. That'll attract them.
Yeah. What size diameter are the trunks on these trees?
Approximately 4 to 5 inches right now.
Okay. That's a size where, again, I'm speaking not necessarily based on any research, but many years ago we used to do tests for the city of Madison. They were mandated to do a survey of all the elms and oaks in the city for Dutch elm disease and oak wilt. And they would bring me in any suspect oaks or elms that they thought had disease, and then we would confirm. And they would bring in their information sheets, and I would look at the diameters of the trunks of these trees, and a lot of them typically were about 6 to 8 inches in diameter. That seemed to be my spin on this, is that that seemed to be the size that started to become attractive to the insects that carry the Dutch elm disease fungus. So your trees may be small enough in diameter that they're not super attractive to the insects, and you may have more problems as they get a little bit bigger. That's just observational on my part, but yeah. It's kind of what we saw over the years.
Keep an eye out. Keep an eye out, Lee. Thank you very much for calling. And let's take another Lee in Watertown this time. Hi, Lee.
Hi, folks. Thanks for taking my call. I've actually got two questions. One is for my neighbor. She has a hydrangea vine that's only got one blossom on it, and she would like to know how she can fertilize it to get more blooms and stuff.
How old is this plant?
She said it's like 5 or 6 years old.
Okay.
And it has bloomed.
It has. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Huh. Now, I don't remember whether those bloom on new wood or old wood. Ooh, I think it's new wood, but maybe if they bloom on old wood, what could have happened is that there was some damage to the flower buds over winter, and you might just not get a very good set of blooms this year. If it's on new wood, then she might expect a few more. Maybe it's a little bit later this year. It's really hard to make things bloom, you know, unless they're like annuals in pots. You can try a fertilizer that has a little more phosphorus in it, but I really don't recommend it because most of our soils have so much phosphorus in it already. I don't think it's going to help.
Right.
And you wouldn't want to use a really heavy nitrogen fertilizer because that'll just encourage more leaves at the expense of flowers. If I had a way to look up whether that blooms on old wood or new wood, I would have a better prognosis for you.
We'll look that up. Yeah. We'll look that up. So stay listening.
And just to let you know, I have a climbing hydrangea that I've had for probably 15 years that has never bloomed, and I'm assuming that it's just
not getting enough light.
Well, could be that it's not getting enough light, but I also kind of figure that probably the leaf buds are hardy here, but the flower buds are not.
Yeah.
So I like it because the foliage is variegated, so it's quite pretty.
Oh, yeah. You've got Samantha or one of those.
It's growing up my chimney, so yeah. It's finally gotten to the top, and it's not blooming up there either. So I don't think it's light.
It's a light
yeah. issue. I think it's something else.
If it's not variegated, I've grown them too. And I've had them bloom in sun situations and not sunny situations. But I think if it gets to be too shady that you might have problems. So maybe – but if she's had problems or not had problems before,
I'm wondering
kind
about
of wonder
winter
about
injury
winter
again.
Injury. Yeah.
They do bloom on new wood.
Okay. Well, then she may still get some more this year yet. A lot of things, the growth is just kind of slow this year. Again, I'm assuming because of winter damage. So she may still get something, but I wouldn't really recommend a product for getting more flowers.
Getting more flowers, sure. So thank you so much, Lee, for that call. Appreciate it.
Oh, wait, he had something about bleeding hearts, too.
Oh, yes, he had his own question. Yeah. Lee, let's go back to you. Sorry.
When is the best time to transplant bleeding heart? Because I have to take down a porch, and I don't want to lose the bleeding hearts when they do that.
Yeah, if you can, they should be finishing up blooming pretty soon here. So as soon as they're done blooming, you could go ahead and transplant. The other thing is you could have transplanted them before they started blooming, but I know they go dormant pretty soon after they bloom, so you want to do it while you can still find the things.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm suggesting after.
Very good points.
One thing I'm going to suggest after you transplant that is be very careful to clean off any of the tools that you have used. One of the problems with bleeding heart is a virus called tobacco rattle virus, and oftentimes the plants are infected, but you don't see any symptoms at all. They do beautifully. I have one in my yard that's exactly like this. It's loaded with the virus, but it grows really profusely. It blooms profusely, but you don't want to transmit that to other plants. So any of the tools that you use, you want to use a really heavy soapy solution. What we normally recommend is about a 10% solution of shampoo. The active ingredient that you're looking for is sodium lauryl sulfate. Huh. And then you can buy online a lab detergent called Alkanox and use about 2.5 tablespoons of that per gallon of water. And then you clean any of your tools with that. It helps deactivate the virus. That's one you don't really want to spread around.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Lee, for calling. Appreciate it. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. One of our guests, the other, Brian Huddleston. He directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to Garden Talk. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston answering your garden questions today. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. We're going to jump right back to our phones and to Ruth and Eau Claire next. Ruth, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. And the question I have is that I've had tomatoes in the past and ended up with blight. I have a small garden, so it seems like I can't really put tomatoes in there again because of the blight. And I'm wondering what's the best way to put them in a pot? I have a Roma cherry type tomato and then one other.
So you're looking at what size pot should you kind of use for that and what type of pot. Lisa, what do you think?
Sure. So the Roma is going to be the easiest because it doesn't get as tall. I would recommend a container that's probably about 10 gallons for the Roma. You know, the bigger that you can get, the better. If you can get a 15-gallon container, if you can get a whiskey barrel, that's a great size for growing the tomatoes in. You do want to make sure that whatever it is has a big enough base and that you have it well trellised so that when the wind comes, you don't, you know, have pots blowing over or anything like that. That's why I really like the whiskey barrels because they're heavier and, you know, you can usually put your trellis so that there are holes in the bottom that you can, you know, put the legs of the trellis through. I'm not a big fan of the actual tomato cages, but there are different kinds of trellising systems that you can use. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's perfectly possible to grow them very well in containers.
You may still get some disease, though, even when you grow them in pots. So make sure you're thinning and removing some of the leaves and the suckers to open up airflow to keep them as dry as possible. And water from the bottom. Don't sprinkle irrigate over the top. That will help as well. And then also with Romas, I worry a little bit about blossom end rot. Those typically are a little bit more susceptible to that. That's actually a calcium deficiency in the plant. So making sure you've got good fertility in the soil, particularly calcium, and then good watering to make sure you get the calcium into the plants will help prevent that from being an issue.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. We have Rich in Madison up next. Hi, Rich. Rich, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Hello there. I have a couple of quick questions. So, first of all, as it relates to blueberry plants, I've done like all the soil amendments, and I had three absolutely really, I mean, my pH was right, and the plants were responding really well. And I'm curious what the natural predators are. Is it bunnies or deer? Because one of them just got absolutely, I mean, it just got eaten right down to the
nubbies.
To the
rabbits. Rabbits really like them, unfortunately.
Okay, perfect. That's good to know. And then I just had a question about tomatoes, and it escaped me. So, hey, that's what I needed to know. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I've had rabbits eat blueberries. That's just
right down to the ground.
Yep.
Marilyn in Duluth, Minnesota. Hello.
Hi. My daughter just moved from one area of Minneapolis to another, and in her old house, she had some peonies that she how do I, is it possible to move them, you know, like if they haven't started blooming, could I move them right now? I know, you know, that you have to put them about the same level and everything, but if they haven't started blooming, is it okay? And then would I have to wait until after they bloom that to take them, you know, to transplant them?
Well, actually, the best time to move peonies is in the fall, so I am not real sure how well it's going to do in the spring, even if it's before blooming. Certainly before blooming would be better than after. I just don't know.
You don't have any choice.
Yeah, if you don't have any choice, I guess you got to do it. But yeah, definitely the best time to do it is usually the fall.
There you go. And let's
just be careful. Get as much around the roots as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Ron in Antigo has something for us. Hi, Ron.
Hello. Hey, when people call in and talk about what's a great pesticide, you know, to knock down bugs, you guys should always mention diatomaceous earth. We buy the food grade stuff. You go to your local rummage sale, get a 25-cent flour sifter, scoop it in that bag or pour it into the bag, and put it on everything. Up here in White Lake, it knocks down potato bugs. I grow shiitake mushrooms. About the only thing that eats a shiitake mushroom is a snail. You put a little bit over the top of the shiitake mushrooms, it knocks down the snails. It's the perfect pesticide.
So, a food grade.
Interesting.
There's a food grade diatomaceous earth.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that can certainly work in certain situations. It's mostly a contact sort of issue. It's not a systemic. So for something that is in the soil, it would have to actually contact it. It works well for some soft-bodied insects, like the aphids. It works really well for snails, certainly. That would work well. It might deter some things, like you were mentioning with the potato beetles. The larva is soft-bodied, so it could certainly how it works is basically by irritating the skin or exoskeleton of the insect or with the larva, the whatever the outer layer is called. I can't remember on the larva. And so it tends to cause them to desiccate and die. And for insects that might want to lay eggs or something, they might find that particular texture unappealing. But I'm not sure, like for cutworms or something like that, because they work under the soil. I'm not sure that it would work for
everything.
But
yeah.
Yeah. It can certainly work, though, for a number of different things.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. Jolie in Mosinee, what's on your mind?
Hello. I'm calling about with rhubarb. I'm wondering with rhubarb, when I see this big bulb and I'm thinking that's going to seed, if I cut that, will my rhubarb still continue growing and I can still pick it? And then when is the final time that I can pick rhubarb?
Okay, so what you're seeing is a flowering stalk developing. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you can certainly cut that off. That will actually be good in terms of leaf production because the plant won't be putting energy into producing a flower. You should be able to continue harvesting rhubarb for, if it's an older plant. Is this a newer plant or an older plant?
It's an old plant.
Oh, an old
Someone
plant.
Someone gave me cutting or giving me roots from another rhubarb.
Now, if later in the season, you'll notice it, usually people only harvest it, you know, up until it starts to get really warm because the stems, the petioles of the leaves start to get kind of fibrous and nasty tasting. So there is still a particular time. Harvesting younger leaves as opposed to older leaves might help. As well. But yeah, it will continue growing and actually might increase its growing.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, George, you have a quick question?
I have a question and a comment. My question is, how many either like a beef steak tomatoes or cherry tomato into a bale of straw?
One.
And then my comment was to the person who was having problems with their grass. There is a product called there's a grass product called Grant Park Mix, and it's available from a store down in Franksville, Wisconsin. So
Grant Park Mix. Thank you very much, George. And really, most people try to put two tomatoes on their straw bale, and I can tell you
it's too many
from experience that two is too many. But there are other things you can put in the bale, other things.
Kale.
Other things that actually work very, very well. Well, Lisa Johnson, one of our guests today, is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. And Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest today, Brian Huddleston, the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison, and with Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Always great to have them come by, and thank you for listening in. Lots of questions and calls, and I think we'll go back to the phones and Faith and Waupun next. Hi, Faith.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a coral bell plant and a Indian summer rebeckia that doesn't want to grow. It's just peeking out of the ground, and that's been for at least a month, and it doesn't do any more. And then I'm wondering about a bleeding heart, why it doesn't blossom.
Okay, the bleeding heart, is it new, or has it just been transplanted?
No, it's been there for years. And my daughter has a piece off of it, and hers blossoms all the time.
It must be then some kind of situation that it doesn't like. Is it growing under black walnut? I know they tolerate it, but it doesn't mean like it.
No, it's out in the open. It's along a fence. But
is it in full sun?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I would move it to be in partial shade. That could be inhibited from blooming.
Yeah, for sure.
The coral bell, you said coral bells aren't growing? Is that what you said?
Right. They're just peeking out, and that's been at least a month that it's done that, and it doesn't grow anymore. And I don't know if there's something I could give it or...
You're in Waupun.
Yeah, it isn't in an area that stays really wet, is it?
No.
Okay.
Did you have good snow cover?
Oh, that's a good question.
If I had what?
Good snow cover over the winter?
Oh, I did, yes.
Okay.
I covered it, yeah.
Probably not winter damage then. I don't know on that one.
From a disease standpoint, root rots sometimes can be an issue.
Well, that's what I was asking about the wet soil.
But we had a wet summer last year, without having wet soil. So it could be that you have an infection in the root system that's basically inhibiting growth. But without seeing the plant, it'd be hard to say for certain that's what's going on. But
plenty of rain up there this year, too.
Yeah, and it's been very wet, and wet conditions tend to be very favorable for the root rot organisms to be active. And I know that corbels are quite susceptible.
Yeah, and the rudbeckia, too.
Would be as well.
Yeah, so it could be that.
So would you just leave it alone and see what happens?
That's about, well, unless you, you know, unless you wanted to dig it up and check on the root system, which also might not help it out a whole lot. But are these close to each other?
I planted until August of last year, and I was wondering if it got a late start.
Oh, okay. You just planted it. Oh, yeah. That's probably what's going on. A lot of things have been really slow this year. Are these both in the same area?
No, they're not.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd just give it some time then.
Right.
That would be my recommendation as well, and see how it does.
So there you go, Faith. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. And Rose in Menominee Falls, it's your turn.
Oh, hello. I heard at the opening of your show you referred to problems with burning bushes.
Yep.
And I have some. They're old. They have leaves on the bottom, sparse, but leaves, and some leaves on the top, and they're all kind of dead through the middle. And I wondered if I could just cut down those bushes to the point where the leaves are growing from the lower part.
You can certainly do that. It's hard to know if there's been a lot of vascular damage in the, you know, in the root system, whether it'll come back satisfactorily or not. But yeah, that is a pattern that we see, is that they're pushing from the base or even from a graft or sucker type thing from the roots, and then some at the very tips. So that is a pattern that I've seen. And yeah, I mean, I probably wouldn't keep it the way that it is.
Yeah, this would be another situation where you have an opportunity to maybe put in a better plant in that area if it looks really bad. And I think if you're cutting all that material out, it's not going to be a very attractive shrub. So unless it has sentimental value, I would consider replacing it. And we don't really recommend burning bush anymore anyway.
Because they're invasive. They're actually on the DNR's invasive plant list. There are a few cultivars that are not on that list, but most of them are.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Rose. Good luck. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Maddie. She had a photo of a plant that started growing behind her garage. She thinks it might be knotweed. And it is.
Yep, it certainly is. Sorry about that, Maddie. It is really hard to control. You can try digging, but the rhizomes are just really deep, and they're very difficult to control. And if you leave a piece, then they tend to come back. You can, if it's in a, it looks like it's really close to a fence, so I'm not sure that you can get a mower back there. If you mowed about six times during the year, you know, you can eventually probably kill it that way. If you don't mind using herbicides, I'd recommend a product with the active ingredient triclopyr, which is T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R. Garlon is one of the brand names. And I'd cut the plant down and then paint that on the cut stump. If you have any leaves along the bottom, you might do that too. And you probably have to keep doing this for a few years. Brian's been battling it in his yard
25 years
or so. Yeah.
But I have not tried to use herbicides, and I'm to the point where I may try that because I don't like to use pesticides in general, but it's getting irritating enough that I kind of want it out of my yard.
Yeah.
There you go. Bill in Milwaukee will turn to you next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I love your guys' show. Now, I'm actually in the process of getting ready to plant a Three Sisters garden. But my thing is, since the soil, well, the soil where I live is old factor ground, I'm having to use planters for it. Specifically, I'm using a bunch of repurposed water barrels. And I was just wondering, since this is kind of my first time planting these, I mean, is there anything specific I should think about? I know my planting order effectively, but it's like, if these are, you know, 55-gallon drums, you know, plastic drums, so anything I should specifically focus on, no, just to make sure that I have a successful growth?
Is this barrel cut in half, or is it 4 feet tall?
4 feet tall. I'm thinking about cutting it in half, but...
Yeah, I'd recommend that because the corn is going to get pretty tall for you to harvest. So I assume you're using corn, beans, and squash, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. That size is probably okay as long as you have sufficient drainage. I mean, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. I wouldn't plant too much corn particularly. I'm thinking of the root system on that.
Yeah.
It might work. I don't know that I've ever heard of anybody doing it in a container.
So what the heck? Give it a try.
Yeah, give it a whirl.
And see what happens.
But yeah, I'd definitely cut it down and just make sure that you have holes punched in it for drainage.
Well, if you cut it in half, you're going to have plenty of hole.
Yeah, but that's in the top.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Becky in Milwaukee, it's your turn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just out to my raised garden, and we have a 4x8 raised garden filled with Mel's mix, and we have had nothing much for pests in the past, but as I laid the garden out a few weeks ago, I put some pots on top the soil, and when I went back a couple of days later, there were some tiny, I can assume maybe they're cutworms under the pots. And I bought diatomaceous earth and sprinkled it around and hoped that that would take care of it. But I went out today and I pulled a little pot up and there were more under there. Is there anything I can do about them?
Are these hard-shelled worms?
It's hard to tell.
Okay.
They're really rather tiny. I'd say they're under an inch long and they're very thin.
Yeah, that's probably millipedes. Millipedes are... I guess they're an arthropod, aren't they? They've got, if you look at them really closely, they've got a lot of tiny little legs. Does that sound like what you're looking at?
No, what I saw was more the type that curl around. And I didn't see any legs, but maybe they're just in a very young stage.
That could be too. The thing is that they love to be under, you know, pots or flagstones, or they like that little area between whatever it is that you've got on top of the ground and the grounds. They like those moist areas. We tend to, oh gosh, last year I got tons of calls from people that had them in their basements and garages because of all the moisture. And because they're just there and because they're curling like you describe, I think that's what they are. If you were to pick one up, you could probably feel what the texture is. We do have a nice fact sheet on them at Brian's website. They're not anything harmful. They like to eat organic matter in the soil.
Yeah. See, nothing to worry about there.
Yeah, as long as they're not, like, jumping all over the place, in which case I might worry that they're jumping worms. I think you're probably fine.
You're okay. There you go, Becky. Thank you.
I mean, they could be wireworms, too, I suppose, but those tend to be flat.
Yeah, they don't
curling up like that.
Yeah,
curling makes me think millipedes as well.
Rick in Thorpe, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Yes, hello?
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, Larry. Sure. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
My question is, we had, in front of our house, we had a hydrangea. It was like 8 feet tall, over the windows and the whole thing. And then on each side of it, we had arborvitaes, you know, nice little globe ones, but they totally got out of control. And I cut them down this spring, and I was going to pull the stumps out. But now the hydrangea is growing from the stump. And I'm wondering if I just leave it there, will it grow back?
Do you know what kind of hydrangea it is?
That's a good question.
I don't know
if it's the one that grows on new leaves or old leaves or whatever.
Are the flowers big and puffy? Puffy white?
Big and puffy, yep.
Kind of circular?
Yep, that's what they were.
Okay, that's probably Hydrangea arborescens, most likely, and Annabelle. And those do grow from the roots, so you should be fine with that. You can cut them down to the ground every year, and they will come back up.
Yep, for sure. So you're safe.
Yay.
Yeah. Assuming you want to keep the hydrangea.
Yes, right.
Yeah, assuming you want to keep it. There you go, Bill. Thank you. Let's take another call here. Rick and Thorpe? Did we have Rick?
Yep, we just did Rick.
We just did Rick. Oh, sorry. Jeff in Fox Lake.
Hello?
Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I have a question on rose bushes, which is going to be the opposite of what most people are doing. I got a multiflora rose infestation, and it looks like they're dead.
Awesome.
Well, I hope that I had to deal with the cold weather. I hope that that's what took them out. My biggest question now is, these are quite large. It's a huge expanse of them. A few of them have, like, you know, they got a great big bush, but there's like a couple of green, tiny green leaves coming. Other than that, it looks dead. My main question is, what do I do to make sure, I mean, I don't want to encourage them to try and live.
Yeah.
Can I cut them off at the ground, or is that going to make them want to take off again?
I suspect, unfortunately, that probably they will try and come back from the ground, whether you cut them, the dead stuff off or not. Just because that's what they do. What you could do is when you see, if you cut them off, when you see new stuff coming up, you can try treating it with an herbicide if you don't mind using herbicides. The root systems tend to be really massive, and it sounds like you've got a lot of them. So I'm not sure it's practical to try digging them out. How big of an infestation do you have?
How large of an area?
I think we lost him. Okay. Well, yeah, I would cut off the dead stuff regardless, because there's no point in leaving that around. But I don't think it will encourage them any more than not cutting it off.
So there you go.
That's how they grow.
Well, let's see. We have some emails I wanted to address as well. Matt in Wausau emailed to ask if biofungicides are safe and effective for treating late blight. Biofungicides.
Those are like the Bacillus or the Bacillus.
There are
subtilis?
Some products that are biologicals that we do have, listed for control, I believe, of late blight. What I would suggest, because I can't remember this information off the top of my head, we do have a very nice fact sheet on fungicides for use in the vegetable garden. It's available at my website, and let me plug that since we've kind of been talking about that.
Yeah.
It's P as in Paul, D as in David, D as in David again, C as in Charles, dot WISC, short for Wisconsin, dot EDU, short for education. In the main menu, you'll see a fact sheets tab. If you hover over that, you get a drop-down menu, and you can just select all out of that drop-down menu. That gives you an alphabetical listing of all of our fact sheets. And I'm trying to think how this one is.
What's the title? Yeah.
I think it's called Fungicides for Use in the Home Vegetable Garden.
Yeah.
If not, you can email me. There's a contact on the main page that has my email address on that website, and I can send you a copy of that. But it lists both organic and non-organic options for treating vegetables, but we do have everything that's organic tagged, so you'll know which is which. And I think that's a nice reference to use if you want to try to treat something in your home vegetable garden for diseases.
There we go. Bill emailed to say he has a rhododendron bush that's leggy with no flowers in the middle. Should he just cut it down?
I'm trying to find this one.
It's way on the bottom of our email.
On the bottom. Okay, there was one from John I saw about plums. Oh, there it is. No, wait, that's a different bill.
So okay. It's rhododendron bush.
Yeah, bush that is leggy with no flowers in the middle. Well, yeah, rhododendrons tend to be marginally hardy here as far as flowers, a lot of them. Some of them, it depends on, you know, where you're growing it. If you're farther down in the state, you tend to have better luck. If you cut it down, though, I'm not sure you'll get very good regrowth. So if it isn't flowering, if that's the reason why you're growing it, I don't know whether it's one that needs more sun or one that needs less sun. So there's, you might think about transplanting it, although with rhododendrons that often makes them die as well. If you've had it for a while, it's not flowering where you have it growing, then your choices are either transplant it someplace fitting its needs or, yeah, take it out. I don't know, though, that cutting it down is going to help you a whole lot.
Colleen, we were talking about Japanese maples earlier. She said she had let her dead Japanese maple sit, and the next year it came back from the base.
Not necessarily surprising, given that oftentimes those are grafted, so probably it's sprouting from the rootstock. And so it's not going to look much like what she had before if she lets it grow. This would be a situation where my recommendation would be to replace it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Peggy in Mondovi emailed that her backyard is in deep shade, and we were talking about that earlier as well. The grass is thin. Moss and Creeping Charlie have taken over, and she's decided on the perfect solution. The Creeping Charlie is low-growing, green, and smells nice. The moss is tough as nails and hardy. A few ferns come up here and there, too. They like it, and it's a lot less mowing.
My philosophy as well.
There you go.
I like that as well. Bill emailed to ask if red oak can get bur oak blight. And if so, what do you do about it?
Yeah, that's not a disease that's considered to be a problem on red oak. It's specific to bur oak. There are a variety of different diseases that can cause problems in red oak. If you're seeing a lot of permanent dieback or even tree death, my first thought would be probably oak wilt. And I would recommend, if you're seeing trees decline, get a sample into my clinic, and we can test for that and other diseases as well. There are a variety of things that can cause dieback, though, on oaks. They include the oak wilt that I mentioned. There's an insect pest called two-line chestnut borer that tends to come in when trees are stressed, and it will cause a lot of branch dieback and can kill trees. And then there's another fungal disease called armillaria root disease, that where the fungus will infect through the base of the tree, through the roots, and can cause a slow decline and death. Usually with that one, you'll get loose bark at the base of the tree, and then you'll see kind of a flat fungal structure form between the bark and the wood. And it will also produce these root-like structures that are very creepy, that grow out into the soil looking for the root systems of other plants. And then also there is a mushroom called the honey mushroom that's produced in association with that particular disease organism. So there are lots of things that can go wrong with oaks.
Lots of things. And cedar apple rust, we talked a little bit about it. Is that going to be a problem?
Oh, it's been going gangbusters this year. I saw it several weeks ago here in the Madison area, and I was just on a teleconference this morning where it's really going great guns up in the River Falls area. It's pretty much a cosmetic disease, though. The fungus alternates between junipers, particularly red cedar, and then certain rosaceous plants like crab apples and hawthorns. But it's pretty much cosmetic.
With that, we are about out of time. Lisa and Brian, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been great fun, and we'll get back together and we'll do it again.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW Madison. Always great to have them come by, and they will be with us again for sure. Monday, Mike Bino, editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine, is back with us on the show. And then we'll get the latest on spring weather from our weather guys. So we'll look forward to that as well. In the meantime, hope you have a great weekend, but stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.